lifestyle choices, and environmental factors impact your brain health and the physiology and psychology of your mental health. When you're ready to turn your brain on to get your game on, listen to In Your Head Radio. Now here's your host, Lee Richardson.
Thanks for being with me today. Today I've got a really interesting show. I've got David Marquet, and he has a great imagination. He imagines a world where everyone engages and contributes their full intellectual capacity, a place where people are healthier and happier because they have more control over their work, a place where everyone is a leader. He is the best-selling author of Turn the Ship Around, the Turn the Ship Around workbook, and the new number one release, Leadership is Language. Fortune magazine called Turn the Ship Around the best how-to manual anywhere for leaders on delegating, training, and driving flawless execution. David, thanks for being with me today.
Thank you, Lee, for having me on your show. And thank you all you listeners for spending your time with us.
So you've got a really interesting background in leadership. And I think everybody's comes into a leadership role in a really unique way, and everybody has an interesting story, but yours is very, I mean, you're the former submarine commander, and that's a different environment to lead on. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, my story kind of goes like this. I came up through the Naval Academy, and my definition of leadership at the time that was in our textbook was, leadership is the art and science of directing the thoughts, plans, and actions of others, directing their thoughts, plans, and actions. And it's a well-known depiction of command and control leadership, which I was really good at. I was really good at sort of stepping back, seeing the problem first, seeing what we needed to do to make it better, and then getting the team to do it. And this got me labeled as a good leader and someone who should be promoted, and they made me a submarine commander. But in the definition, the architecture is leaders make decisions and teams execute the decisions of the leader. It's not about getting the team to think. And if it's about the team making decisions, then it's simply how decisions. How are we going to do what the leader has told us to do? It's not what decisions or whether decisions, whether or not we should even do it, or why are we doing this? Those kind of decisions are reserved for the leader.
Well, you know, it's hard for me to think that way because, and I guess because this is my second business, as an entrepreneur, and I've had to do a lot of things that not necessarily I wanted to do, but I had to know the why.
Right. I got there in a roundabout way because I was after I was assigned to be a submarine commander, and I studied my ship for a year, which the Navy has the luxury of doing before you actually take command. I got transferred to a different ship with 2 weeks to go, one of the newest ships in the fleet, a ship I didn't know. And when I showed up, of course, this idea that I was going to give orders and tell people what to do wasn't going to work because I didn't really know the ship. So of course, we'd always encouraged, quote, empowerment and proactivity and creative thinking and distributed decision making, like I think most organizations do and most leaders do. But now my life depended on it. Now my life depended upon the team telling me what they really actually thought we needed to do, not just try and listen to me and then follow the tea leaves and then just give me back what I wanted.
Well, was that something that you could put in place pretty quickly? Was there some transition time from one style to the next?
It all happened pretty quickly for me. I took over. I only had 2 weeks, and so now I'm the commander, and I'm standing in the control room, and I kind of give this innocuous order, which was irrelevant for the submarine that I was on. It would be like asking someone to shift into second gear on a motor that only had one gear. And but the scary thing is the officer repeated the order, and the crew just sort of like looked at us like we were being silly. And when it all you know, and unraveled very quickly that there's only a one-speed motor. And I looked at the officer and I said, well, why did you repeat this? First I said, hey, did you know? And he said, yes, I did, sir. I said, why did you repeat it? He's like, because you told me to. And I think a lot of us can, like, delude ourselves into thinking this never happens at my organization. But we know from studies and we know from experience and we know from things like Boeing 737 MAX and Wells Fargo and Volkswagen that these things happen all the time. So I made a deal with my guys. I would never give them another order. So imagine a submarine commander or a CEO who never tells people what to do. That was what we aspired to. Now, of course, I did. But I shifted my focus to creating the structure where people could tell me, and we used a keyword called intent, where they would say, I would say, hey, here's what we're intending to achieve, or here's what we're trying to achieve. And then they would say, well, here's what I intend to do. I intend to submerge the ship or load a torpedo. And that got them thinking at the what level and the why level, not just at the how level. And it had amazing consequences.
So tell us more about those consequences.
Well, this was the worst performing submarine in the fleet, and it had the lowest morale. Only 1 in 10 sailors who had a chance to sign up in the Navy signed up. And as of the day we implemented this program, it shifted 100% of the sailors signed up to stay in the Navy. Morale soared, and we got the highest score in the history of the Navy operating the submarine. And it all happened because I stopped giving orders. It all happened because what we did was we activated the thinking on throughout the entire team. So rather than having thinking happening at the top and doing happening at the bottom, which is the traditional view of hierarchy in organizations, we got thinking to penetrate throughout the entire organization, and not just thinking, but people able to express what they were thinking.
Those are amazing results.
Yeah. That's... So of course I was very happy with that, but the thing I'm actually more proud about is over the next 10 years. So I left the ship and the ship continued to do well, which of course I was happy about. But not all leaders are. I mean, leaders. I know people who actually secretly want things to go to pieces once they leave, because they that can just show how, quote, invaluable they are. But that's not leadership, in my opinion. But the thing that I was really proud about was that 10 submarine commanders eventually came from the ranks of the people who served with me. And I think it's because they were thinking, even as junior officers, we invited them into the thinking space of the captain and the department heads and the second in command. And so as a result, it was natural for the Navy to view them as future captains and then promote them through the subsequent steps to let them be future captains. That's a really highly disproportionate number, taking 10 from one submarine.
Well, it sounds like you left a good legacy behind. How long were you in the military?
28 years.
So it sounds like you were rocking it. What made you decide to move on?
Well, I wanted to tell the story, and it was basically impossible to do inside the military. After this time on Santa Fe, I had a couple of jobs in the fleet, and then I ended up going to the Pentagon. That was not a good place for me. I didn't feel like we were using the kind of things that I learned on the submarine to have honest conversations about what was going on. We were, quote, debating, unquote, the invasion of Iraq at the time. But they were all, in my mind, it was pure theater, because we all knew what the decision had already been made. The president had already made the decision, the Secretary of Defense and the Vice President were all aligned. And we weren't there to say what we should do. We were just there to tell them how we were going to do something that they already decided. And it was, it affected my health being in that environment, especially, I think, because I'd seen a better way. Affected my health in a negative way, and I had to get out, and I wanted to tell the story.
Well, it's so interesting, because that's one of my favorite lines is, you know, the body keeps score of everything going on in the brain, and it took its toll on you.
Yeah, and it's really Yeah, it was really unexpected. I developed a heart condition, and I was always a very active athlete, and I just started, I couldn't walk upstairs. I was breathing hard, and when I went for a physical, they rushed me over to the hospital for a test, and my life expectancy was predicted to be 7 years based on how damaged I was.
Wow, how many years ago was that?
That was in 2008.
Ah,
So I'm like way past my expiration date, but I'm on, yeah, I got out and moved to Florida. I got a good cardiologist. I'm on medication. I'm very active, and I may keel over, but I'm probably,
we're all going to
prep.
keel over
Yeah, I'll
eventually.
keel over eventually, but I really try to embrace life and just do everything I can because I'm really truly am on quote borrowed time. But I am much healthier than I was, and I haven't looked to see what my quote predicted life expectancy would be, but I'm sure it's way out there. I plan on living to 110. I think we all kind of, we sort we make our dreams too small. Our dream is, oh, my dad lived to 87. My dad's still alive, but sort of it's like, well, my parents lived into their 80s, so I hope to live into my early 90s. I don't think we're thinking big enough. I think, and so as a result, we don't do big things. We invest in with too short of a time horizon, and I may not live that long, but that if you shoot for 90, you're probably not going to go to 110. But if you shoot for 110, you might make 95.
Well,
So
I share
that's where I'm at.
that type of thinking, and I think that you have to you use the word intent earlier. Set your intent,
Exactly.
put out to the universe what you're looking for. So you got out of the service, you got your health back,
Yeah.
and you got you got the opportunity to tell your story.
Right. So I'd really like to share with your listeners what we're working on now, because I think it's really interesting, and I think it's probably the most useful book that I've got going on. And it's about making better decisions in your life. Because from a work perspective, I spent a lot of time giving people the ability to make decisions, but I always wanted them to make good decisions, of course. And we know that one of the main reasons we get derailed from good decision making is that our egos get in the way. And by this, I don't mean sort of a bombastic, obviously over prickly person. I just mean that when I come to make a decision about whether I should move or stay in my current job, I'm over biased towards maintaining status quo because I was the person who decided to take the job that I'm in now. So therefore, changing jobs sort of admits that that wasn't the best decision, and that's very painful, and we shy away from it, and so we don't truly embrace that as a potential outcome, and so we end up doing things for longer than we should. And there's a whole number of examples of this. We're allergic to feedback when we should be seeking it. At the same time, we know that some people have talk about out-of-body experience where there's this dissociation. Especially during a traumatic event, they've had a heart attack, their heart stopped, and they describe seeing themselves as the paramedics are working on them. And when people tell traumatic stories, researchers have noticed that sometimes people will shift from this happened to me, and I to you. They'll say something like, well, at this point, you feel this. And again, there's this sort of natural instinct by the brain to step out. And the phrase is, the word is distance ourselves from ourselves. And so what we started thinking was, what if we could deliberately manipulate this stepping out where rather than waiting for something to happen by chance, when we're in these points where we have to make decisions, and we know we're going to be overly influenced by being in our immersed self, viewing the world from my perspective, why don't I just step out and then look back at myself, make a decision from a more dispassionate, more like what a friend would tell me, more like what my coach might observe and tell me. And then I step back in, and now I'm gangbusters moving forward on this new decision. And we think that will result in really mitigating this tendency of the ego to muck up our decision making.
Well, and you know, emotion plays a role in decision making too. There's no doubt that there's the emotional impact. And we started talking about that, you know, Aristotle did. It's between the head and the heart. So new science certainly recognizes that the emotions impact our decision making. It impacts how we collect our data, impacts how we analyze our data, and then how we execute our decisions. So in decision making as a leader, do you have a process? Do you have a criteria an approach that you take with every decision?
Yeah, for me, I say be someone else, be somewhere else, be sometime else. So here's some examples. Let's say you need to make a decision. This is something I would have to do a lot as the submarine commander. Okay, who's going to do this task? Or what team is going to do the task? Now, if you have a short-term perspective, you take the best team or the best officer, and you assign them the task. Let's say it's driving the ship into port, which is something we don't do that often. We might do it 20 to 25 times a year. And a lot of times we're being evaluated. And of course, when you're driving in and out of port, that's when you're more at risk of running into things. So you put your best person up there, and you do that for 3 years, and then they leave. And then now you have a big problem because no one else knows how to do it. And the other thing is the other officers who went to the rest of the Navy are not carrying the skill of driving the submarine into port. So the way I would do it is I looked at my calendar, which was set for six months past today. And I would kind of flip it, but it would always be 6 months in the future. And I would look at that date and I would say, so we're in March now. So in September, what would the captain of September want the captain of March to do? What would the David of September want the David of March to do? And when you think about it like that, you say, well, if I keep using the same person, we're going to have these negative impacts in the long run. And that would sort of clear it up. So that's an example of be some time else. Be your future self. People say, oh, well, consider what this impact will be on the future. That's a good start, but it's not quite the same as actually inhabiting your future self and then looking back to today. When Bezos had to make a decision, he had to leave a good, well-paying job on Wall Street to start this thing of selling books on the internet. And it was not guaranteed to work. And he tells a story where he said, I imagine myself at 80, what would I regret more? Starting the company and failing or not starting the company? And he decided he'd regret more starting and not starting, not even trying. And so that's what keyed him that leaving his job, starting something risky was the right way to go. And when you're on the far side of the decision looking backwards, it frames as regret, and we are more biased to do it. When we're on this side of the decision looking forward, it frames as a threat or a change, and the bias tends to push me towards not embracing the new.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I own the Brain Performance Center, I own the Brain Performance Institute, and I come at everything, you know, from a brain perspective, a psychology perspective. and the role that the conscious plays and the subconscious plays. And Gerald Zaltman of Harvard Business School stated that we make 30,000 to 33,000 decisions each day. And about 90 of those are subconscious decisions. So it's not a conscious choice that we're making, because we have so much going on that we're unaware of. And that, you know, the statistic that says every minute your brain is capable of taking in 1 million bits of data, and that somewhere between 40 and 126 go into the conscious level. Personally, I think it's 40, but yeah. we don't have to do the math. It all goes into that subconscious. And I think a lot of times that's why I'll work with clients that that are having trouble making decisions for their company or for their personal lives. And they'll say, you know what? Come in and they'll say, you know, there were negative consequences from that. Why did I do that? And my answer to that a lot of times is, you know, have you checked in with the subconscious? And I don't know how that fits into your model on decision making.
Well, I mean, certainly we know that there's a lot more stored in the subconscious that we're not really aware of. And in the Navy, we would call it our spider sense. Something would be going on and you'd have the sense of impending danger, or a sense that things weren't the way you initially thought they were when you started the plan. Like, the enemy's not to the north, they're actually to the south, and what's to the north is a decoy, and you're being lured in the wrong direction. And then studies have shown, for example, one I'm thinking about is this this card game where they gave people rigged decks and they had them draw from cards, and they had like skin conductivity to measure perspiration and anxiety, which is a proxy for anxiety and unease, and their bodies would show that they knew that which deck was rigged before, and they were told in the study, hey, tell us when you figure out which deck is rigged. And their bodies would know it before they would vocalize it. In other words, the conscious would know it. So it's out there. But this is a slightly different thing. To me, the conscious is sort of going into an immersed state, and I think there's value there. But I think it's also valuable to just ask it, well, what would a good friend tell me right now? For example, there's a story from Henry Marsh, who was a neuroscientist and a doctor, and he wrote a book in the UK. And he was famous because he was the doctor who would apologize if he made mistakes. So that kind of set a new trend. But at one point, he got cancer and he was all mopey-dopey. And he was sad, but he kind of persisted in the sadness. And then he framed it up. He said, you know, I really wasn't living life at this point. And I kind of withdrew. And then I asked myself, if I were my friend looking at my situation, what would I advise me? I would say, get over it. You're wasting what precious little time you have. And so we think that outsider's perspective needs to complement that internal thing, because the internal self will know things that no outsider can ever possibly know. But the outsider will also see things that you won't know about yourself.
I think that's a really good point. And a lot of times we don't recognize we all have biases. And, you know, we all have the confirmation bias. We're looking for data that supports what we believe. We're looking to have that data that says, okay, Lee, you're right. You know, you're on it. But there's other kinds of biases. And I think that they all come into play. And I think we routinely and automatically believe ourselves first. And then we get that confirmation bias coming in there. And so, oh, I don't want to see that new information. I don't want to see that, You know, I want to focus on that data that supports my expectations.
Exactly. So,
yeah. But I think that if we can better understand our own cognitive biases, I mean, how about the recency bias? That's to me, because you know what just happened is top of mind.
Right. Yeah. And people die because of these confirmation biases. So you might remember the airplane. This was Asiana 214, which was coming into San Francisco. This is about 2015. And it came in too low, and it hit the seawall before the runway, and the tail broke off, and three people died. And so we studied that. We looked at what the what they were doing in the cockpit as the plane was approaching and what the pilot said afterwards. And it turned out he was being evaluated. He was an experienced pilot on smaller airplanes, but he was being evaluated for this big 777. So the more senior pilot was sitting in the co-pilot seat as an evaluator. Now, when you're being evaluated, that tends to push you into this immersed sort of self-aware image management. It's sort of like taking a picture for Instagram. Like you're into image management and performance at this point. And the plane was coming in. They saw that the lights were going from two white and two red to three red and then four red. But the pilot never saw four red, even though he should have, because the other people in the cockpit did. And of course, they're coming closer. And four red means you're way low. And I think this is an example of this of confirmation bias occurring at the pre-perceptual level. It was so uncomfortable for his brain to show him that data that the brain actually filtered it out and didn't even let him vote on that. But it starts with a pre-level of, he said, oh, I really didn't want to see four lights, because he said something like this: I don't want to see four lights because I knew it would mean I failed the evaluation. He didn't say it meant I was putting 300 people on my airplane at risk of dying, and this is what happens. Our ego hijacks, instead of being task focused, landing the airplane, it's like image management. Oh, I'm going to fail my evaluation. So we know these things have huge impacts.
Well, they do. And I think that, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, there's an optimism bias too. You know, we're looking, we want to be the most optimistic that we can possibly be. So
yeah.
that bias plays both ends with us. And I think that it's important to just recognize it and challenge ourselves. I mean, if you mentioned ego earlier, and I always say, if you can check that ego at the door, you know, you can check some of those biases at the door too.
Well, and we think that this practice of stepping out and looking at yourself, so instead of like feeling like I'm the quarterback playing my life on the field, you're the coach. You're sitting over on the sideline and you're looking at you, and that creates a separation. And instantly you'll see things more clearly than from the immersed state. There's a story where Gordon Moore and Andy Grove co-founded Intel, which started as a company making memory chips. But then in the early 80s, the memory chips, they were starting to lose money because memory chips, there was too much competition from Asia. And it seemed obvious that they needed to stop it and start making microprocessors, which is what we know Intel for now, the CPUs. But they just couldn't decide. And then finally, Andy Grove tells a story where they're having a meeting. He's just he and Gordon Moore, who was the chairman, and he says, hey, what if we were replaced? What would our replacements do? And then immediately they said, well, they would get out of these storage memory chips and they would get into microprocessors. And there's no new information, but it's just getting rid. It immediately framed it in their brains as, well, this is not me. I'm no longer having to pass judgment on the fact that my identity is so associated with these memory chips, and boom, it's instant. instantly seeing clearly what the right thing to do is. And of course, they went on, and now Intel is going great guns and with the AI and everything else.
Yeah, and that's a great story, because, you know, that's basically checking in with yourself, which is something I advise every client to do on a regular basis, because there's days, you know, I'm off just a little bit. I'll check in with myself. What do you need? Gosh, all I've done is work, you know, nonstop for the last 4 days. I need some social engagement. And just by checking in, then I can make sure I go get that. So, you know, every time I think about decisions and behaviors, I just completed a PhD, and Dan Kahneman, his book, Thinking Fast and Slow.
That's a great book.
Isn't that a great book?
I mean, yeah, so good.
That helped me understand how attention and laziness and how associations and judgments, all of those will drive our behavior in very predictable ways.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great book. Kahneman, of course, unfortunately passed away earlier this month. But yeah, we lean heavily on Kahneman's research and all these biases. And we really do feel like a lot of them, like this overcommitment bias, really do stem from the fact that we really are living inside our own heads. And if we could step out every once in a while, we'd be better off. Andy Duke has a book called Quit, which I also really like. And then she talks about our problem is we don't quit things that we've started, even when it's evident that we should. For example, climbers on near the top of Mount Everest, but their watch says you need to turn around because you're not going to get to the top. But they're like, oh, look, the summit's right there, and they press on for another 30 or 45 minutes, and they die. We know these things happen. So stepping out and saying, well, what would my coach say? What would my friend say? We think really, what would my future self say? We think we're really helping in those situations.
Well, I agree. And I mean, there's so many great books. I was at Wharton a couple of weeks ago, and I picked up and I met Angela Duckworth and her book, Grit. And that in itself, you know, you're talking about stepping out of yourself. It's showing up and don't getting distracted and making efforts that count. You know, and I love the way that, you know, how gritty are you? Because we've all got to have some grit. And after reading her book, I recognize that comes from the outside in, you know, it really does. When you think about some of the, because you're as a leader, you led for many years, you came out of that role, you went into more of an analytical thinking role about leadership and researched that. And as a result of that, you've shared that knowledge in your books and workbooks. If you look back over time, if there were one fact or approach or piece of information that you would like our leaders to know and kind of hold on to as a takeaway, what would that be?
Yeah, I'm going to shape the question to what I want using the old media trick. It's not so much what I want them to think, it's what I want them to do. I want them to practice, because our belief is we act our way to new thinking. The way we change our brain is by action, physical action. And there's a connection, body controls the brain, or the brain controls the body, but the body also shapes the brain. And so here's the act. The next time you go to a restaurant, or 10 times, do this 10 times. Next time you go to a restaurant, don't order. See if you can get the server to choose your meal for you so that you know what you're going to have when they put it in front of you. And the reason we like this as an activity is because it's going to force you to, quote, empower the server, if you want to think about it that way. And we run into leadership teams all the time. We get hired to help leadership teams create more thinking in their people. But it tends to be external, and they approach it as a thought experiment, and we think leadership is really more like a sport. It's more physical. It's more about doing and acting, and that by this practicing this, you get it. You'll know what it feels like, and you know what it takes. Because if you can't get that server, because some of them are going to say no, like try it at McDonald's or Chick-fil-A. Some of them, it's going to be really hard to get the person. They're going to say, oh, well, you know, I really recommend the chicken sandwich. And they're going to say, and you're going to say, okay, I have the chicken sandwich. In other words, they just tricked you into you telling them what you wanted. You let them off the hook. And so you have to say, you know, it's on you. You decide whatever you pick is going to be fine. And you will learn what it takes to get that person to make decisions, which is exactly what you need to apply at work.
Well, and I think that's a great example, because that's doable. Everybody can relate to that, and everybody will have an opportunity to execute that. So I think that's a fabulous, not lesson, but idea to leave our listeners with.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, because I think it's all about, we all want to be leaders. We all want people to do what we want them to do without really having to put a lot of effort into it. And what I've heard you say is, if you let people think, if you give them the space, if you give them the knowledge that, hey, you can do this, people will step up and will become great leaders. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners have thought at times, you know, I can think of a time I could have been a better leader, you know, but looking back, unless I can learn from it, if I can learn from it, then I'm all about looking back. But if I can't learn something from it, you know, we just got to let it go. So you're on to new things. You've got a new book coming out, and we've got just a few minutes left. And that new book, you want to tell our readers, listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, that's so a lot of what I'm talking about here, this being able to step outside ourselves, be someone else, be somewhere else, look at yourself from the balcony, say, for example, don't be on stage. Like I give a lot of speeches, so I picture myself, I'm on stage, I'm physically on stage, I look out at the audience, I'm behind my own eyeballs. But if it gets tense, or someone asks me a question that's a little bit provocative, I jump to the balcony in my head, and I'm like, okay, I wonder how Dave is going to handle this. And it creates a little, you know, I let go of that trying to be in a performance, and I can just be honest and less and more relaxed. And so the Be Someone Else, Be Somewhere Else, Be Sometime Else is this new book. It's going to be called Hey Coach, or something like that, or Be Your Own Coach, or The Coach Within, something to do with the word coach. But I'm super excited about that. We've been talking to audiences who are trying it. People are reporting some interesting things, useful things. We're applying it ourselves. I'm helping it with some of the relationships that I have in my family, extended family that need that. You know, for a long time, I just blamed other people. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to step forward, and maybe I'm really the problem here. So it really has helped me.
That is great. Well, we've got a couple of minutes left. So for our listeners out there that might want to learn more about you, I'm sure you have some kind of online presence.
Yeah. Yeah. So David Marquet, Marquet. My first book's called Turn the Ship Around. Of course, it's available Barnes & Noble, Amazon, other online booksellers. And it tells a story of what happened on the submarine. But the thing I think that's probably fun also is we have a YouTube channel called Leadership Nudges, where I have these little tidbits like go to dinner and don't order. And we now have something like 400 of them. I've been doing it for every week for about 8 years. So that channel is called Leadership Nudges. Go there. Also, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn. I say yes to every connection, or follow me, l.david.marquet at LinkedIn. Say hi.
Well, you know, thank you so much, David, for being with us today and for sharing your thoughts. And it does my heart good to say, hey, if you reach out and connect with me, I will respond. You will not go into a black hole.
Yeah.
I appreciate that very much. And I look forward to the new book and learning more about how to step out of myself. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
On behalf of Lee Richardson and the Brain Performance Center, we want to thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear more episodes like this, visit us on iTunes, Google Play, TogiNet, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and thebrainperformancecenter.com.